Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson is out. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the mega mall project known as American Dream Miami can now move forward. Last night, county commissioners voted 9-1 to approve changing the growth plan and zoning designations, thus giving the green light for Canadian developer Triple Five the chance to go forward with their plan for the largest retail space in the country. One side believes this is going to create a destination as big as Orlando and bring thousands of jobs to the area. Of course, there's a lot of criticism from environmentalists who say this is a disaster. And of course, a share of residents in North Miami near the Broward County line where they say this project is slated to go. They say there's a scare that traffic is just going to become even worse. And of course, here's what some of you have been saying so far. Here's Anna in Broward.
Florida is the most at-risk state of climate change, and apparently Florida's GDP is projected to be affected by over $100 billion due to climate change. Approximately $400 billion in housing is set to be underwater too. This is really scary. And also, the Everglades is key to the ecosystem and mitigating climate change effects. However, the Everglades are already starting to deteriorate, and this mega mall will be built on the fringes of the Everglades, apparently.
Also, Nicholas Daniel Rivera and Hialeah wrote us, yes, so much commerce for the Miami-Dade area. Maybe we can get more efficient roads and transportation. He says he's looking forward to finding a great job there. At Murph V underscore tweeted us, how can they look at the death of malls and shopping plazas nationwide and decide opening a mega mall is a good idea? So how do you feel about the American Dream Miami? Are you excited? You're going to hit the ski slope? Or what about the traffic nightmare that may come? If it does, as they some claim, are you a parent? Do you think there's a lack of indoor entertainment and we need this in South Florida? We'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Also love to hear if this is, again, up to 14,000 jobs possibly coming. We heard from one listener said, great, looking forward to maybe getting one of those jobs. Joining me now in studio, Jim DeFede, investigative reporter for CBS 4 News Miami. Jim, always great to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
Danny Rivero is WLRN reporter, and he was at the commission meeting last night, so we're going to find out more about that. Danny, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian Bandel is reporter at the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy Friday.
Danny, real quickly, you were at the meeting last night, 9-1. We've been hearing that this is kind of a done deal. Like, it would have been a surprise if they had voted this down.
Yeah, it definitely had the feeling of a foregone conclusion from the get-go when the meeting started. You know, at one point, attorney Miguel Diaz de la Portilla asked everyone to stand up who was for the development, and it was really just a tiny section of people that remained seated. So inside the chambers, it absolutely felt like from the beginning that this was going to go through.
Was there any surprise at all? Did anybody say anything that was surprising? There were environmentalists who've been against this for a while. Were they there in droves? Did they speak up?
There were people that were speaking up. I would say that they were outnumbered. A variety of public officials. You know, there was mayors from surrounding municipalities, from the city of Hialeah, Miami Gardens, who came out and just said, you know, we're absolutely all for this.
Was there the other thing too? The other big issue has been traffic. How much did they talk about that?
They talked about traffic quite a lot, and actually, the later part of the meeting, right before the actual votes happened, it was all about transit. And they actually pulled out a stop that a lot of people weren't expecting. They tacked on that they made a resolution that the county will have to work with FDOT, with the Florida Department of Transportation, to develop an extra lane of busway along Miami Gardens Road in order to expand and kind of have a lane strictly for transit. And that might be reversible. I mean, a lot of things have to be worked out, but that was actually included in part of the plan. It turned out to be, you know, a big topic.
What they're trying to do is connect Miami Gardens Drive to the 27th Avenue, where they want to have a transit corridor for part of their SMART plan. So that's the hope, is they'll have transit on 27th, and then you'll get on Miami Gardens Drive and take a dedicated bus lane to the mall.
Yeah, and Brian, yeah, the interesting part about this is before there was conversation about, well, should we make the developer pay for some sort of rail system or transit system to try to alleviate this coming traffic monster that's now going to come because of the mall.
Well, the developer is going to pay for a lot of road improvements. They're estimating $210 million in road improvements that have to be done before they're allowed to open. And then on top of that, there's an estimated $58 million in impact fees. Part of the controversy between the commissioners is some commissioners wanted the impact fees all in the area near the mall, so it would improve the cities like Miami Lakes, and other commissioners were like, that's not fair, we want it through the county. And in the end, it was normal, it was through the county.
What do you say, road improvements? Widening of roads, adding more roads? There's only a couple of ways into this
both,
spot.
Both. They're widening roads. They're adding new roads. They're adding, four new exits on the turnpike and I-75. So for those of you who drive along there, you know, there's going to be a lot of traffic traffic from construction in the next 5 years it's going to take to build this, widen the road, build the exit, and all that.
Again, I want to hear from you, though. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Looks like this is going to happen. So now what? How are you preparing for this as it's coming? Are you looking forward to it? Maybe you think this is great, and you're looking forward to everything that this project is going to offer, because it's not just a mall, as they say. It is going to be like an Orlando destination. Maybe that's something exciting for you if you're a parent. 800-743-9576. Jim, Broward County was threatening a lawsuit. You think they're going to do it now?
Yeah. No, and I'll be the naysayer. I'll be the contrarian. I've been around long enough to know. I remember when the Board of County Commissioners voted near unanimously to build a massive airport in Homestead, you know, the Homestead Air Base Development project. That never happened. You know, I can remember when Wayne Huizenga wanted to build a huge sort of entertainment type facility on the Dade Broward line that would rival again. Everyone always talked about it would be a new Disneyland. There was land segregated for that. There was a lot of talk about that. That never happened. The commission vote is a step, but, you know, environmentalists do not tend to go to commission meetings where they know they're going to be outgunned by politicians who take campaign contributions from developers. So instead, they rely on the court system. So you can expect to see lots of lawsuits. I can guarantee you anything this close to the Everglades is going to end up in federal court. The notion that that this is going to open in 4 to 5 years, I wouldn't buy my tickets just yet to fly down for the opening.
And just to add to that, there's a whole litany of permits that the company needs to get. So and that's from how they're going to get the water, if they're going to recycle the water, you know, a lot of transit things. So this is by no means done. They have a lot of hoops to go through, including probably the court system.
You know what, Brian, real quickly, just a little bit of history here. This has been in the works for a number of years. Really, who's the one who's been pushing it the hardest?
Well, 555 is the company that owns the Mall of America in Minnesota. They're also building American Dream Meadowlands in New Jersey, which has many similar features to this, although not quite as big in some of the features. So they certainly have the money, and they've done it before, although the project in New Jersey has been delayed and taken longer than they expected, though that they say it's going to open next year. But, I mean, the company has resources. I think the big question is, will they be able to get the about $4 billion they need to build it? You know, it's a tremendous amount of money, even for someone who has a lot of financial resources.
And didn't they also pay for a traffic study that they later kind of just poo-pooed because they didn't like what it said?
Well, they went with a traffic study, and they went back and forth with the county officials, with state officials, and eventually they settled on the number of about 70,000 vehicle trips. That's what they eventually settled on. A day, yes. That's what they got.
Okay. Danny, why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because one of the head developer of the company, as Kander Ghermezian, I actually talked to him yesterday, and he completely contradicted even that study right before the commission meeting.
His own study.
So to me, the politics of this is what's going to be interesting. Danielle Levine Cava was the one no vote. She's expected to run for county mayor in 2020. You can expect that she will use this as a wedge issue. So I think the politics of this are also going to get interesting. Again, I'm also old enough to remember when Miguel Diaz de la Portilla, the lead lobbyist on behalf of the developer, was a county commissioner who, when he was a county commissioner, wrote many of the rules and regulations that were designed to block developments like this from the western part of Dade County.
By the way, we do have a cut from one of the developers, again, Eskandir Gurmezian, who was talking about the traffic issues. This is what he said.
There is no traffic. The report are all exaggerated. The traffic will be one-third of the report. Nobody goes to the amusement park or water park or skating rink at 9 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. They all go at 11 o'clock, 11:30 when there is no traffic. Or they go after the supper.
All right, so this guy hasn't driven in Miami, I guess, because he doesn't understand how traffic works here. But I'm sorry, if it's not just during the early hours. All right, again, the number 800-743-9576. I want to hear from you. I want to know what you think. Is this a good idea, a bad idea? It's not a given yet. They've just, the commission said, okay, the zoning is going to be there. We want to move forward with it, but there's still a lot that has to happen. I'm going to start with Dean in Miami. Dean, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Go ahead.
Listen, Dean, I think this is the worst possible plan I've ever seen. We've been under drought restrictions for the last 3 months. I haven't heard anybody talking about where the water is going to come from. There's 40 construction cranes building high rises in downtown Miami. Where's the water coming from them? Every year we're in a drought. These guys are going to take my water. They're going to be the largest water consumer in Dade County. Where's it coming from?
Brian.
Well, the city of Hialeah has a recently completed water plant that goes down to the Floridian Aquifer, which is actually the deepest aquifer there. And that's they're going to get the water out of there, do reverse osmosis. So there actually is a water supply in that area. They built that plant specifically because they were going to expand development in that region. At the time, they didn't know what was getting built there, but they have the capacity. Probably the bigger issue is stormwater runoff. Like normally the rain just goes straight and is absorbed into the ground. So the question is, where is all the stormwater going to go? Is it going to recharge the aquifer? And they'll have to come up with a system that's designed correctly to make sure that the water is put back into the aquifer after it falls on the site.
Dean, thank you so
and
much.
And how about all the deep water injection that they're planning for the sewage and the radioactive water from the power plant? That's all supposed to go into deep well that's down in that area. It can migrate.
Well, the power plant is in South Dade, so I don't think it's that connected to American Dream. But that's kind of a countywide issue where they have to solve the water supply countywide. Yeah, and that's something that all Miami-Dade County needs to solve.
All right, let me go to Denise in West Miramar. This is going to be in her backyard. Denise.
Good afternoon. Thanks for this call and opportunity. Yes, it is in my backyard. My home for the past 17, 18 years is Miramar Parkway and Dykes Road. Overall, I'm not crazy about the location due to traffic congestions. However, I am excited about the job opportunities this may bring. Also to include not having to guess where it is that I'm going to take these visitors of mine who love to come to South Florida. However, overall, there is a concern about the possible adverse effects on the Everglades. So I'm looking forward to hearing more. I'm going to stay in tune. I'm going to voice my opinion moving forward if there is an opportunity to do so. But overall, I'm looking for the experts to think this through clearly, make sound judgment, and if it's eventually determined not to be a good fit, that those persons who are in charge, not only today, but moving forward throughout our life cycles, will be reasonable and make good decisions on our behalf. Thank you.
Denise, thank you so much.
Has she met the Miami-Dade County Commission? I'm just curious. Because reasonable and thoughtful are not usually words associated with the commission, but we can always hope and dream.
How different is a commission going to look, within 4 or 5 years, and this thing is still maybe being built at that point?
Well, I mean, because term limits are finally kicking into
because of lawsuits.
The term limits are finally kicking into effect, so you're seeing a lot of county commissioners having to give up seats that they've held for a long time. So you're going to start seeing some new people running. Where they fall on this issue is going to be is going to be a very interesting question. You know, will you see the benefits in other places? You know, so I think that's, I think nobody can predict what the commission is going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, but it's going to be different, that's for sure.
And if it's still stalling because of lawsuits, can you foresee a situation where you have new commissioners coming in, and like in Fort Lauderdale, a very different project, but basically you had a new group of people come in and kill the Wave streetcar because they just weren't for it. A new commission can come in and say, we don't want this.
They could. It'd be hard, you know, to repeal some of those things. The question is just whether or not the developer wants to continue to stick with the cost and the expanse of it. And plans always look great on the drawing board. And then suddenly, you know, things get scaled back and scaled back. The other thing that last point I'll make about this, and look, the last caller made reference to, it's a nice place to take people who come into town to visit. You know, you're talking about malls that are in Minnesota and New Jersey that are not necessarily nice places to visit. In South Florida, people tend to come here. I don't know if you fly from the north during the winter and you come to South Florida and your desire is to go indoors into a mall, or is it to go out and participate in the sun. But hey, if the developer thinks it's a winner, then good for him.
A lot of people come to Orlando to go to theme parks, amusement rides, water parks.
Is that what they're selling? They're trying to sell this as a big theme park, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference. If it was just a mall, if it was just 3.5 million square feet of retail by itself, it wouldn't work. The difference here is this is an amusement park where they're saying it's going to have rides similar to what you find in Orlando. It's going to have a water park that's indoors, so when you get there, your day isn't ruined by a thunderstorm. It's going to have the only indoor ski slope in the U.S. So the idea is to be a tourist attraction, things that we don't have. It's proven already that amusement parks work in Florida. It works in Orlando. It would work here.
Is that a selling point, a ski slope in South Florida?
So to add to that, the developers, their main selling point, at least yesterday in the commission meeting, was that this is not a mall. You know, they're saying over 50% of the property is dedicated to entertainment.
And there'll be hotels. And
exactly. So as far as, you know, the traditional mega mall, strictly retail, they say they are not going in that direction.
Yeah, look, one of the calls did say this, and we've heard a couple of people also on Twitter. They've even emailed us and said, this is great, jobs. All right, and the developer saying up to 14,000 jobs. So let's look at the positive. Is there a positive to this? Is there a plus? That's jobs, right? Brian?
Yeah, it will create jobs. Keep in mind, a lot of those in hospitality and retail probably won't be the highest paying jobs. You probably won't be able to buy a house with that kind of a job. Some of the jobs, of course, might be a little higher if you're the manager of a store or manager of a hotel. But yeah, it will create jobs in the market. And, you know, if you create a lot of jobs, perhaps the salaries will rise because companies will start getting desperate and paying more. Although we haven't seen that in today's job market yet.
So, I mean, is there any also, I mean, would something like this help boost the area, more development, boost home prices, anything like that?
It will definitely help hotels because it's expected to draw 30 million visitors. So probably more hotels will be needed, more hotels will be built, probably more flights in the airport if more visitors come. Home values, it depends where your home is. If you live in the area, there might be a reason to put your home on Airbnb now, you know. Previously, why would you want to Airbnb a house, you know, in Miami Lakes? But now you're right there. And I think in Orlando, you see there's a lot of homes near Disney that people kind of use as either second homes or rentals, you know, to tourists.
And that is actually, in fact, a major sticking point with environmentalists because this is so close to the Everglades. So if you're going to build additional housing that's not there right now, you know, you'd be encroaching a lot onto the urban development boundary. And that's a big fear for people that live in that area. And then the other question is, will that housing be affordable for the kind of workers that are going to be working there, which are a lot of retail jobs, you know, somewhere around the mid-20,000s is what we're looking at for the salaries.
Let me go back to the phones. I want to take this call. Andrea in Miami. Andrea, thanks for holding.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What's on your mind, Andrea?
Well, I mean, I just think with all the issues that Florida has, focusing on bringing more entertainment is not what I think the focus should be on. Going back to what Denise said about hoping that the commission will do what's right, I just laugh at that because I they're obviously going to go with what makes more money. As a mom, I don't even see this as a good thing. I don't know how other people are saying, you know, jobs and, but exactly what you just said, they won't be the highest paying jobs. Well, and I mean, just look at what's happening in Disney right now with the workers.
And Andrea, you said you're a mom, so this doesn't seem appealing, this
no,
theme park?
No, it doesn't at all. It really doesn't at all. I love Disney. I love going to Disney, but just because of everything that's happening with their workers, I've decided not to go until they give them a raise. And so that is how I would feel about this too. You know, if I just don't feel like everybody would benefit, or the majority of people would benefit from this. I think a very small percentage of people would actually take advantage of the entertainment there.
All right, Andrea, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Let me get one more call in here. I want to get, it's Chaim in Miami Beach. Chaim, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Chaim. What are you thinking?
Mr. Defiti mentioned that it's too close to the Everglades. You should know that this land is within the government-set-up, government-organized urban development boundary. That means within this urban development boundary, you can develop urban projects. That's arranged by the residents and the government. And the land is designated, I'm not sure if it's zoned, where you can build 8 million square feet of industrial. There's another 1,000-acre industrial park under construction right near there. That means that warehouses, trucks, cement plants, tow truck depots, landfills can be built on that land now. All right. This is doing is making less square footage and making it prettier.
All right. Chaim, thank you so much for the call. As we finish up, I'll let you answer that, Jim.
No, look. The one thing that Dade County has well done is create an urban development boundary line, and this is inside of it. But anyone who doesn't think that building something like this near the urban development boundary line isn't going to create enormous pressure to push that boundary line and to break it and move further west into the Everglades is crazy. Eventually, this is the camel's nose under the tent.
And again, this is not something it's green lit by the county commission. Of course, they're changing the zoning to allow for this. But still, as we've heard, so many things have to happen. And there's still a lot of time. Obviously, a story that we're going to follow through as it continues to unfold in front of us. Jim Defiti again with CBS 4 News Miami. He's going to stay with us throughout the show. Danny Rivero, WLRN reporter, and Brian Vandell, reporter of the South Florida Business Journal. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we take a closer look into the controversial Promise program in Broward. Is it really helping kids beyond keeping them out of jail? That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we learned that the Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz, was referred to a controversial program in Broward schools called the Promise program. That program was created to keep students from having to go through the justice system. But what do we know about the program? And who is put through that program? And how do we know that it's really helping these kids that they're supposed to be helping? We'd like to hear from you if perhaps you've been a parent who's had a kid in that program. We'd like to know more about it from your perspective. It's 800-743-9576. Before I get into that, though, and actually, let me, I just want to mention Jim Defiti, investigative reporter for CBS 4 News Miami, still in studio here with me. Also joining us is Jessica Bakeman, WLRN's education reporter. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
And Caitlin Emma, she's a Politico reporter covering education. She joins us via Skype. Caitlin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You know what? I just wanted to mention real quickly, because this is a breaking story. It's a national story, but it has a very strange tie into all of this. There is a school shooting that occurred in the Houston area earlier this morning. And it really, as much as I can tell you, looking at the reports, up to 8 dead. This is, again, a school shooting at Santa Fe High School that happened earlier this morning. And, of course, what I can tell you is that stay tuned throughout the day. WLRN will keep you updated on that story. This is a couple of months after the Parkland shooting. You know, again, where 17 people died. And we've actually been hearing from some of the Parkland students who have been very vocal. They've been on Twitter talking about this shooting, right, Jessica?
Absolutely. So, you know, that never again was the theme of their movement, and that meant that there should never again be a school shooting. There have been other shootings at schools since Parkland, but this one looks like it's going to be a pretty bad one, with 8 or maybe more people dead. So Jacqueline Corin, who's one of the students from Marjorie Soman Douglas, who's been one of the more outspoken students, tweeted, "My heart is so heavy for the students at Santa Fe High School. It's an all too familiar feeling no one should have to experience. I'm so sorry this epidemic touched your town. Parkland will stand with you now and forever." And I saw on Twitter also that today is the last day of school for seniors at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Again, the story that we're going to be following, that NPR is going to be following throughout the day. So just stay tuned throughout the day, and we'll get you as many up. We'll up, keep you updated on the story throughout. So moving back to Broward County, we were talking about the Promise Program, and the big story was within the last couple of weeks when we learned that, and Jessica, was through your reporting, that we learned that the Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz, the Q shooter, was actually put into the program, or he was enrolled into the program, was supposed to go through the program?
He was referred to the program in 2013 when he was in middle school after committing a vandalism infraction in a bathroom at Westglades Middle School. And this is significant for a couple of reasons. One, because the superintendent, Robert Runcie, had said over and over again there was no connection between Nicholas Cruz and the Promise Program. He said it was reprehensible that anyone would try to make a connection between the shooting and the Promise Program. And he even went so far to call people who were raising questions about it. He referred to that as fake news and said it was agenda driven. So I ended up, through reporting, found from two sources that he was referred to the Promise Program, took that information back to the school district, and they ultimately confirmed it. And they have said that they're working on a report that is going to come out next month that will have more comprehensive information, they say, coming from an independent or third party report showing his Nicholas Cruz's full educational and discipline experience in Broward. But the circumstances certainly didn't help the fact that there was already this growing pushback.
And Jim, it was like a couple of days after that report, Robert Runcie at a school function, a public function, basically said, "I'm not a liar." But really, what has this done to his reputation in the district? Do people still trust him?
I think Robert Runcie is still largely trusted. I think that what it really shows is how decentralized and disorganized the record keeping was for Nicholas Cruz in terms of the different groups, the different entities that he interacted with. There was no central repository of that information. We had been requesting it from the beginning. We were denied it under federal privacy laws as well, but it was also clear to us that they had not really gathered the material in a way. And that speaks to a larger question, which is, if there isn't a central place where Nicholas Cruz's information was funneling into during the course of his time in school, then who was monitoring his interactions?
Did the superintendent speak out of place when he was asked about that? Just he didn't know and he just said the wrong thing?
Well, I think his frame of mind was as it related to his expulsion, that the period of time that he was at Marjorie Soman Douglas and at the prior school that he had attended, where he was having disciplinary problems, where there were expulsions, and eventually he left the school system. It was in that context that I think he was referring. I don't think he was thinking all the way back to the middle school time. And in fairness, let's talk about the Promise Program briefly, because I do think that Robert Runcie's initial inclination was to defend the program because he feels strongly for it. And there are reasons to be supportive of the Promise Program. And there's a similar program in Miami-Dade school system. And the reason that they came about, and particularly in Broward, was that the NAACP had done a study showing that in Broward County you had the highest percentage of African Americans being funneled into the criminal justice system from the school district than any other school district in the state. And so in order to try to prevent that prison pipeline, so to speak, that you created an intervention program. I spoke to Senator Rubio about this after Jessica came out with the story that she had, And he said, look, he still supports that notion of trying to create a program that not every infraction, not every kid who is involved in vandalism should not necessarily have a criminal record.
It's to keep the kids from having to go through the judicial system and not have that record and give them an opportunity.
But it's more than that. It's just, let me just make this point. It's more than that. It's not just divert them from the criminal justice system. It is also supposed to give them the type of counseling and care and attention that they might not necessarily get in the criminal justice system where they could just get lost. And that seems to be where things have failed.
Caitlin, there are programs like this around the country. Again, we keep hearing this is controversial, though. Is it this one? Is just that kind of program nationwide is controversial? What, you know, what's the story behind that? Where was the problem?
So this has certainly reverberated at the federal level. Essentially, the Promise program in Broward sort of earned a number of accolades from the Obama administration and sort of served as, you know, something of a framework and inspiration for federal guidance that was issued by the Obama administration several years ago. And that guidance is non-binding, but what it essentially said to schools was, you need to be mindful of whether or not your discipline policies are disproportionately funneling students of color, you know, into the so-called school-to-prison pipeline and, you know, addressing these racial disparities in school discipline, which we've seen borne out by data over and over and over again. But, you know, since this this shooting in Parkland, that guidance, that federal guidance, which, you know, was somewhat inspired by what the work that Broward was doing, has, you know, come under fire from conservatives across the board. And it certainly does not help help the case that now we see that Nicholas Cruz was, in fact, referred to the Promise Program. But we've seen criticism from, you know, senators like Marco Rubio. At the same time, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is now chairing a White House School Safety Commission that's considering whether or not to rescind this guidance, you know, under the criticism that it probably keeps violent children in school when they shouldn't be kept in school.
And I mean, do we know if it's where people will swear by it and the sheriff has supported it, but do we know that it works? Does it do what it promises?
I think what we've seen is a number of superintendents across the country saying, you know, similar to Superintendent Runcie, you know, our rates of out of school suspensions for, you know, students of color are down. And yes, it's working. At the same time, we've seen a lot of pushback from, you know, educators across the country who've said, you know, this essentially ties the hands of our teachers. They feel like they don't have any control over their classrooms. They feel like, yes, it does keep, you know, unsafe children in school. So it certainly, we've seen some data borne out by the fact that racial disparities are maybe improving in school discipline, but it's still, you know, across the country, it sort of depends on the local politics and, you know, what schools are saying.
And just to make the point clear, violent offenses are not supposed to be part of the Promise Program. It's nonviolent offenses. So it's not as if, you know, a situation where if you bring a knife or a gun to school, you can be referred to the Promise Program. That's not what it was intended. And I have yet to see any instances where people have cited that type of thing had gone to the Promise Program.
If I can just jump in there. So one of the things when I was talking to some of the people who were involved in creating the Promise Program, right, there was this group of stakeholders that included not only the school district, but also the public defender's office, the state attorney's office, civil rights groups. And they got together and they came up with this list of 13 infractions. They're misdemeanors. And so they were saying, the idea is if a student gets into this kind of trouble, this level of trouble, that they shouldn't end up in jail. And like Jim said, they should have an opportunity to go to this alternative school. It's called Pine Ridge Education Center in Fort Lauderdale. And they can get counseling. They can get substance abuse treatment if that's what they need. However, there was some discussion or debate at the time that they were initially creating the Promise Program about which infractions should be included. And they ultimately did include assault and fighting. Now, the specific discipline codes that are used for those are some of the lower level. Like it's supposed to be, you know, assault where the other person wasn't badly injured. But there is some subjectivity there in terms of determining whether infraction is eligible for promise, and that decision is being made at the school district level. It's not going to the sheriff's office or the public defender's office. So I think that when the superintendent says nonviolent, that is up for interpretation if you consider fighting and assault to be violent.
Has the school district shared like how the program has worked and how many kids go through it, how long they stay in it, and then they're sent back to school because everything's now better?
They have provided some data. The most up-to-date data that they were willing to provide me when I requested it was from December 2016, so we don't have the most up-to-date information. But the data there, it broke down in detail this claim that the superintendent has made, saying that nearly 90% of kids who go into Promise don't commit another Promise-eligible infraction. However, since my report came out, the Sun Sentinel has done some excellent reporting broadening this issue. And one of the things that they found was that they said that that statistic was misleading. And I'm quoting right from their article now, a student can commit a subsequent infraction without being considered a repeat offender as long as it's not the exact same violation in the exact same year. The following year, they start with a clean slate.
Caitlin, that's a lot to swallow. Caitlin, I wanted to know on a national level if, again, they're tracking these figures just to know if the programs are working. How are they determining success is really what I'm getting at.
I think what we've seen now is a total shift in political climate. So I don't know that the Trump administration is tracking this very closely. We do have the Federal Civil Rights Data Collection. It's a massive set of civil rights data that comes out every 2 years that's self-reported by school districts. So in some ways, you have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. But a lot of the school discipline data is, you know, part and parcel to that. But what we've seen with the Trump administration is really a massive political shift. And I don't know that there's a lot of interest in seeing whether or not this works. I think that there is a lot of interest in possibly getting rid of it and not having school districts to feel like they need to be looking at this issue. And the issue at hand is called essentially disparate impact. And that's sort of examining whether these policies are having a disproportionate and unfair effect on certain, you know, racial groups of students. And this term, this wonky term, disparate impact, has been at the center of all the arguments at the federal level. And some conservatives, most conservatives, just do not feel like it's appropriate for school districts to have to be examining this issue in their school discipline policies. So,
all right. Jessica, real quickly in the short time that I have, help me understand, because I see this pop up a lot, is one of the controversies linked to this program. Briefly explain why I keep seeing this fostering a culture of tolerance. What are they doing? What are they talking about?
So a lot of the people who have pushed back against the discipline policies at Broward are saying, we don't have a problem with Promise itself, but we think that Promise is an example of an more broad culture of leniency toward discipline in the school district. And a lot of the critics have said, I don't want to get rid of the Promise program. I think the Promise program was well intended, but it's not well executed. And so I think what we're seeing is a push, like we know Ryan Petty and Lori Alhadef are two parents of victims who died in the shooting and have recently announced they're running for school board. They want to take a bigger look at the discipline policies in Broward and say, are we going too far in the direction of giving kids second chances to the point where we might be putting their peers at risk?
And a story that will continue to follow. Again, Jessica Bakeman, WLRN's education reporter. We heard from Caitlin Emma, political reporter covering education. She joined us via Skype. And still in studio with us, Jim DeFede, investigative reporter from CBS 4 News Miami. Thank you so much, Jessica, Caitlin. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, what happens to sex offenders when they can't find a place to live? That's all coming up next here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, there are nearly 100 homeless sex offenders who were living in an encampment in Hialeah, but that's ending because they can't stay there. Miami-Dade County has some of the most restrictive laws on sex offenders. They cannot reside within 2,500 feet of schools or playgrounds. Now, we still have Jim DeFede from CBS 4 News Miami joining us, and he was recently talking with Ron Book, head of Miami-Dade's Homeless Trust on his program, and it was a bit of a contentious conversation. Let's listen in.
They need to work to find places to live. Most of the people that were living on 71st and Northwest 36th Avenue did nothing to try to find a place to live between August and
now. They can't afford because
they can't afford what? They can't afford it because Miami-Dade is the toughest rental market in America, and they're unemployable.
No, no. One of the guys who I talk to on a regular basis, he has a job. He's a bus driver. Not a school bus driver, but he's a bus driver, right? He ends up having to go out there every night and sleep in his car.
I wonder where he's driving that bus.
See, that's what you want to do, Ron. You want to stigmatize, right? That's fine.
You know what? Stigmatize? Jim, society said we're going to treat these people differently. That is why they're required
to register.
They're animals,
right? They're animals.
You've never heard me say
you
that.
You consider them all monsters, though, right?
You've not heard me use the word monsters, although at some point I may have referred to them as monsters. You know what, Jim? They're not good people.
So then lock them up forever.
That doesn't defend me. I'd be happy to encourage that.
Fascinating television, Jim. That was a back and forth. That was pretty intense. I mean, look, first of all, let's get an update. Those people are not still encamped in that place, in that area.
Right. They've spread them out. They're now, they basically just moved them to different locations. So just before we went on the air, I spoke to one of the gentlemen who stays out there at night, and he's now staying at another location, maybe about 20 blocks from there, you know, along with about 8 or 9 other sex offenders who can't find housing. And then others are moving down south. And so you're actually just sort of spreading the problem around. You're not getting rid of it. And I just want to be clear. This isn't a question of whether or not you think sex offenders are good guys. You know, I'm not arguing that point. But if you're going to create a system where you have them, you know, do their time, serve their sentence, be released, then the question then becomes to me, how do we create an environment that is as successful as possible so they do not repeat their offenses?
The system as it's set up, once they leave, once they've done their time and they're back out into society, into the system, what are they supposed to do next?
So here's the residency requirement. This was the bill that Ron Book passed and pushed through Dade County. It says that you cannot reside within 2,500 feet of a school. Okay? When you draw 2,500 feet circles around for every school in Dade County, what you end up with is very, very small pockets of places where they can end up living. For instance, they can live on Star Island. You know, there's no school within 2,500 feet of Star Island. If you can afford a mansion on Star Island, they can stay there. Bow Harbor, there are some places down in South Dade. So there are limited numbers of places that they can stay. But understand the irony of this. Reside is defined by the Department of Corrections as where you sleep. So a lot of the restriction for being within 2,500 feet of a school takes place between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. It doesn't. So think about that for a second. Unless there are a lot of kids at school between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m., this law is foolish and on its face. And it's designed to give people the perception that they're safer when they're not. Because when you create homelessness among sex offender communities, you take away the thing that makes them most likely to be able to survive, which is a stable home environment, the ability to get a job, the ability to seek counseling. If you're living on the street, those three things become a lot harder, which makes it more likely to offend. This law actually makes people less safe.
Are all sex offenders basically just lumped into one big pot? These are all the same kind of people when really you're talking about different types of offenses.
The law is designed for sex offenders whose offenses were against children. So let's be clear about that. Ron Book has often makes the thing of saying predator and sex offender as if they're interchangeable. There are specific categories of predator. And let me make another point clear. If when you are getting out of prison, let's say you're a sex offender, before you are released, you go through a screening process. Every sex offender who is released from prison goes through a screening process. If they believe, if the system believes, the state believes that you are likely to reoffend, that you show proclivities, that you are still showing in a way that is unhealthy, unseemly, wrong, they can seek civil commitment. The state does it all the time. If you are truly, seriously a danger to the community, the state has the ability to commit you civilly to an institution for an indeterminate length of time. So the question isn't, you know, isn't are we releasing predators onto the street? The question becomes, how do we get the people who are going to be released? They're going to be released unless they're ruled dangerous. What do we do for them to make their lives and our lives safer by going forward?
What statistics, and I know that you kept, pounding on Mr. Book and on your program about finding the studies or finding the statistics to show, you know, really how much of a risk any of these offenders are after they've gotten out of prison. But
so the residency requirements, so there have been numerous studies about residency requirements, the 2,500-foot rule. Let me just, so, and I'm not talking about studies from left-wing groups. I'm talking about the United States Department of Justice found that these rules are ineffective. In Iowa, the Association of County Prosecutors found that there was no support for the idea that having residency requirements keeps people safer. The state of California, and I'm not talking about the loopy left in California, I'm talking about the Department of Corrections, the Attorney General's office. Go on down the line. The law enforcement community in California that supervises and oversees sex offenders, they issued a report saying there is no basis, no correlation between residency requirements and keeping people safer. It is just a placebo. It is designed to make people feel safer. The state of New York, the state of Illinois, the state of Texas, on down the line, the state of Minnesota, have all done studies that show there is no correlation between where a sex offender lives and who their victim is. Because most children who are abused by a sex offender are either abused by a family member or an acquaintance. Strangers account for a very small portion. And there are laws in effect that if a sex offender is near a school during daylight hours, that if they are loitering with the intent to assault a child or molest a child, they can be arrested. So those laws are in place. The notion of creating homelessness is what's insane.
When you're a sex offender, even if you've done your time, you're a sex offender the rest of your life. You're labeled that way, right?
You're on a registry.
So it becomes very difficult for people to get the employment, as you pointed out throughout the conversation with Mr. Book. It's very difficult for people to get employment when that is basically on your record. So, I mean, how do we move forward in helping many of these folks when they're going to have that label forever?
And look, and again, it's not that I'm sympathetic towards them.
Right.
I want a system that allows us to be safe. And the way to do that is by creating the right environment, letting them go to get the counseling they need, having family support that provides them the help that they need, those sorts of things. So, yeah. So, for instance, the gentleman that I referred to in the clip that you said, he's a bus driver, right? He has a family. He could stay with his family, but because his family lives within 2,500 feet of a school, he cannot sleep there at night. So he's there during the day when the school is in session, because he can be at the house that he lives in, that his family, that he pays rent on and the rest of it, you know. But at night, at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, depending on what his curfew is set by the Department of Corrections, it's either 8 or 10 p.m., he gets in his car, drives to this location, pulls down the seat, and goes to sleep. And then at 6 a.m., he leaves. And he has to be there between 10 a.m. and 6 a.m. because if the Department of Corrections comes and checks on him, he has to be there.
As the city, as South Florida just keeps expanding, those spaces get smaller and smaller and smaller. Do you see a day when there is no, because like there are parts like Miami Beach, you can't. Do you see a day when you're not going to be able to stay in Miami-Dade?
Look, the 2,500, there will be that day. And more importantly, the 2,500-foot rule, one of the things I asked Ron Book, was there a study? Was this scientifically deduced? Because the state has a different standard. The state says 1,000 feet. So Ron Book came up with 2,500 feet. Where did that number come from? Is it a scientific study that shows? No, he's got no scientific study. The law is named after his daughter, Lauren Book. Lauren Book was abused by a nanny that was in their home. Lauren Book is an amazing young woman now. She is a state senator. She has taken the tragedy that occurred to her and is helping other people. This bill is named after her. But by the way, this bill would have done nothing to have kept Lauren Book safe. That's the irony of all this.
And just real quickly, again, that encampment has been, basically those people are being moved out.
That encampment is closed as of right now, but the people didn't disappear. They just moved elsewhere. They moved to new corners that they're staying in smaller groups. It's just the same thing we saw. They were under the Venetian Causeway for a while, then they were at 71st Street, now they're at a half a dozen other locations.
Jim DeFede, again, investigative reporter for CBS 4 News Miami. Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Always a pleasure.
And that's the program for Friday, May 18th. Thank you so much for listening. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. I'm Luis Hernandez, filling in for Tom Hudson. Have a wonderful weekend. Talk to you again soon.